Now the Three Martini Lunch with Greg Corumbus and Jim Garrity.
And welcome, everyone, to the Tuesday edition of the Three Martini Lunch, along with Jim Garrity of National Review. I'm Greg Corumbus of Radio America, good, bad, crazy martinis for conservatives as usual. And Jim, of course, just yesterday we looked at a new poll out of Michigan that's very encouraging. It has Terry Lynn Land up 8 points in the Senate race. It's currently held by Carl Levin. He's retiring, and a pickup in an open seat in Michigan would be a huge feather in the GOP cap and would suggest that it would be a pretty good year nationwide for the party. Another seat that is up, but the expectations aren't even nearly as high as they are in Michigan, is Virginia, where Mark Warner, who was a very popular governor in Virginia, easily won in 2008, is up again in 2014. The conventional wisdom is that he's pretty safe, but a lot of the polling in Virginia suggests his approval rating is hovering right around 50. A plurality, at least, I think, believes that somebody new might be good for the state, and that might have even come from a National Review story. I'd have to check the source on that. Now we see that it's likely that Warner will get at least a legitimate opponent here, former RNC chairman Ed Gillespie. It'll be interesting to see exactly how he formulates his positions as party chairman. You kind of have to go along with the party platform and so forth. It's obviously a state that has trended more blue as of late. Obama won it twice. Even Terry McAuliffe won there just a couple of months ago and is now the governor. So it'd be an uphill climb, but it's another state where Virginia Democrats and National Democrats would have to work a whole lot harder than if they didn't have a credible candidate like Ed Gillespie.
Yeah, and a lot of murmuring around Gillespie in recent weeks. I suppose you could see somebody trying to argue that Ed Gillespie is a too establishment. He's not sufficiently Tea Party. I suppose you could make that in the sense that he's not been in, you know, conservative or Republican politics starting in 2009 or 2010. I mean, this is a guy who's been, you know, RNC chair back during the George W. Bush years. And I remember I first met him back when he was the chairman of the Kasich for President campaign back in the year 2000, which is pretty much before anybody had heard of Ed Gillespie. So this is a very well-connected guy in Republican circles. Not just the Bush crew, but basically every faction of the party has probably known with him and dealt with him. He's done some lobbying in the past, and you can see some folks trying to make hay out of that. I'm really hoping that the Democrats make Terry McAuliffe the point man on the argument that Ed Gillespie is too much of a lobbyist to accurately represent the state, that he's too cozy with moneyed interests. You know, I think Terry McAuliffe is really the guy to do that. Like, it's worth noting that, you know, the argument that he's too inside Washington doesn't work as well when a huge chunk of the state comes from Northern Virginia suburbs and, you know, close to Washington. Gillespie's pretty good on the stump. He actually did a long series of speaking engagements when he was RNC chair and would do debates with Terry McAuliffe and other DNC chairs. You know, obviously he is obviously very tight with the GOP donor community. You know, Mark Warner now has to sweat. I think you can't say that, you know, Mark Warner, who's always had fairly high approval ratings, is going to be, by no means is he ever going to be easy to knock off. But I think it's safe to say that Ed Gillespie can make him can give him a solid run. One person was sharing with me the theory that actually what Gillespie does now, he's going to get, you know, the floor for Gillespie if he gets the nomination is probably 47-48%, right? You know, this is sure. There's still a lot of Republicans in the state. So he does it. He does fairly well. And if he loses, he would be well suited to run for governor when Terry McAuliffe's term ends 4 years from now, which is intriguing. If that is his ultimate plan, that, you know, he wants to be Governor Gillespie someday, I think it's very, very possible he could screw it all up by winning the Senate race. We'll take that consolation prize, Senator Gillespie. So we'll see. But it looks like a good solid race here in Virginia. And that's was not something that was guaranteed this year.
Yeah. And he'll have the resources to point out Warner's record, I think. Warner does a very good job of sounding like a moderate. But if you look at his voting record, whether it's stimulus, Obamacare, right down the line, there's very few deviations from the Democratic line. So
he's always there when liberal Democrats need him, but he just never sounds like it.
Right. All right. On to martini number two now. And Jim, we've got new numbers on Obamacare enrollments, and I use that word with fictional quotation marks around it because we don't actually have numbers on people who have actually paid their premium. So these are just people who have signed up for plans officially. The big headline is that 24% of those who have signed up are the so-called young and healthy, which is below expectations. The overall numbers have been fudged. The administration's talking 6 million. It's a little over 2 million as far as people have actually purchased plans. The rest are Medicaid and other enrollees into government programs, some of whom were already there and just re-upped. And so the numbers are kind of fudgy that way. The way you cheerily put it in the Jolt this morning was, good news, America. There's enough people signing up that there probably won't be a death spiral, just massively higher premiums and costs to taxpayers. So while the numbers might be slightly improving in the aggregate for the administration, the overall arc of this story is not getting any better for them, and most importantly, for any of us.
Yeah, and you know, in case anyone misses the sarcasm in my headline, do you know what causes the death spiral? Higher premiums and higher cost to taxpayers. So maybe they won't be high enough to start to, you know, to kickstart the death spiral the first year. But, you know, everybody's premiums go up. A certain number of people say, you know what, that's too much for me to cost. I'll pay the 2% tax or eventually the 4% tax. In other words, as bad as the extra tax for not having insurance is, it's almost always cheaper than what you would pay for insurance, unless you're getting some sort of, you know, you're in a really good area and the circumstances are just right for you to get a bronze plan or something like that. So the suspicion, this is not good news for the administration. Obviously, the administration has had remarkable success in recent weeks in taking chicken numbers and turning them into chicken salad and persuading people, Obamacare enrollment surging. Well, yeah, when you get six the first day, it's going to surge. Okay. When you have really two abysmal months, then anything above abysmal is pretty good. Now, it's worth noting that it's not just the national pool, that ultimately you've got 50 state pools. And so certain states are going to be in better shape than others. A couple of states have actually hit, you know, are in the neighborhood of what they wanted for their enrollment. A lot of them are way behind. Right before the holidays, I was saying that, you know, 45 of them had yet to hit 10% of their goal enrollment. Obviously, it's up better than that. But look, you're going to end up with people with increased costs. And as Avik Roy puts it, look, when you raise the costs, more people will choose to go without insurance because it's less affordable. If it's, you know, and then what you end up doing is ending up with more people without insurance than you had before, which is, you know, undoing the exact point of passing this legislation in the first place.
All right, on to the crazy martini now, Jim, and this is another bit of reporting that you've done. This can be found on the campaign spot. South Carolina, of course, has two Senate races actually this year. Tim Scott has to win the remainder of Jim DeMint's old term since he was appointed at the beginning of last year, and Lindsey Graham's second term is up. There's been a lot of conservatives hoping to pick him off in a primary. That's looking like a pretty tough challenge right now, but of course Democrats are hoping for a shot at gaining the seat as well. But as you point out today, their bench is a little thin. One guy was a former Obama administration official whose consulting firm was involuntarily dissolved by the state, and another guy has a number of felonies on his record related to financial activities. So not exactly the type of caliber of candidates you probably want to see if you're going to try and pick off a Senate seat.
Where have you gone, Alvin Green? A lonely South Carolina Democratic Party turns its lonely eyes to you. Woo, woo, woo. I had thought the other gentleman, Rick Wade, who's a green tech automotive executive. That should ring bells for folks who follow the Virginia governor's race. Served in the Obama administration, served on the Obama campaign. He's been, you know, a longtime party activist who's got a plugged into the corporate world that tends to be very friendly with Democratic candidates. One of the first things that was on his bio was this firm that was called Wade Axelrod. And I looked at that, I was like, wait, that can't be Axelrod's consulting firm. He can't be a founding member of that. And I went and I looked, no, it wasn't that. Axelrod's firm now has an acronym for the name, but this is a firm that this guy Wade founded with Michael Axelrod, the son of David Axelrod. Okay, fine. Then I looked up the business records, and it turns out it was dissolved last year after being in business for about 18 months. Now, Mr. Wade, as I understand it, is now working for Green Tech in Virginia. I'm not quite sure how he's running for Senate in South Carolina, but if Hillary Clinton can say in her heart she's always been a New Yorker, I guess state boundaries don't matter anymore. But I just kind of find it really interesting that of all the things this guy's done in his life, he mentions I'm the founding partner of Wade Axelrod, you know, business consulting, and the place doesn't exist anymore. It's kind of a straight, like, really? That's your putting your best foot forward, your experience in a firm that's gone defunct? So I thought it was a big deal. The rest of the world didn't seem to think it's a big deal. But Jay Stamper's multiple felony charges, you know, illegal sale of securities in 2006, that seems like a big deal. Ordered to repay millions of dollars, paying $600,000 out of his own pocket. I mean, you know, look, if nothing else, this does give Stamper a great slogan. Jay Stamper for Senate 2014. There was no malice. I never meant to hurt anyone. There were mitigating circumstances. Can't you just wait? I mean, maybe the slogan is going to be Jay Stamper because South Carolina can't afford an amateur crook. They know how to pick him down there, don't they?
Well, Lindsey Graham will be feeling pretty good if he can clear that 50% mark in the primary. If he can't, I think all the drama is going to be on the Republican side, which is probably where it was going to be anyway, but not you really know. So, maybe Alvin Green is the strongest candidate in the Democratic Party in that state. Who knows?
It's a rebuilding year for South Carolina Democrats, and let's think about it. This is a rebuilding year after Alvin Green. This is going from Pete Carroll to Rich Kotite as your head coach, to use a metaphor Jets fans will appreciate.
Jim, always fun. Talk to you tomorrow.
See you tomorrow, Greg.
Jim Garrity of National Review. I'm Greg Corumbus of Radio America. Thanks for being with us today. And please join us on Wednesday for the next 3 Martini Lunch.